The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 10, Side 1.
Take Arnold Soucy, who was sent to camp at the age of about 50. He had never been a believer, but he had always been fundamentally decent. He had never led any other kind of life, and he was not about to begin any other. He was a Westerner, and what that meant was that he was doubly unprepared and kept putting his foot into it all the time and getting into serious difficulties. He worked at general work, and he was imprisoned in a penalty camp, and he still managed to survive. He survived as exactly the same kind of person he had been when he came to camp. I knew him at the very beginning, and I knew him afterward, and I can testify personally. True, there were three seriously mitigating circumstances which accompanied him throughout his camp life. He was classified as an invalid. For several years he received parcels, and thanks to his musical abilities he got some additional nourishment out of amateur theatricals. But these three circumstances only explain why he survived. If they had not existed, he would have died, but he would not have changed. And perhaps those who died did die because they did not change. And Taraskevich, a perfectly ordinary, straightforward person, recalls, "There were many prisoners prepared to grovel for a bread ration or a puff of makhorka smoke. I was dying, but I kept my soul pure. I always called a spade a spade." It has been known for many centuries that prison causes the profound rebirth of a human being. The examples are innumerable, such as that of Silvio Pellico. Through serving 8 years, he was transformed from a furious carbonaro to a meek Roman Catholic. In our country, they always mention Dostoevsky in this respect. And what about Pisarev? What remained of his revolutionary rebelliousness after imprisonment in the Peter and Paul fortress? One can certainly debate whether this is good for revolution, but these transformations always proceed in the direction of deepening the soul. Ibsen wrote, "From lack of oxygen even the conscience will wither." By no means. It is not by any means so simple. In fact, it is the opposite. Take General Gorbatov. He had fought from his very youth, advanced through the ranks of the army, and had no time at all in which to think about things. But he was imprisoned, and how good it was. Various events awakened within his recollection, such as his having suspected an innocent man of espionage, or his having ordered by mistake the execution of a quite innocent Pole. Well, when else would he have remembered this? After rehabilitation, he did not remember such things very much. Enough has been written about prisoners' changes of heart to raise it to the level of penological theory. For example, in the pre-revolutionary Prison Herald, Luchinetsky wrote, "Darkness renders a person more sensitive to light. Involuntary inactivity and imprisonment arouses in him a thirst for life, movement, work. The quiet compels profound pondering over his own eye, over surrounding conditions, over his own past and present, and forces him to think about his future." Our teachers, who had never served time themselves, felt for prisoners only the natural sympathy of the outsider. Dostoevsky, however, who served time himself, was a proponent of punishment, and this is something worth thinking about. The proverb says, "Freedom spoils, and lack of freedom teaches." But Pellico and Luchinetsky wrote about prison. But Dostoevsky demanded punishment in prison. But what kind of lack of freedom is it that educates? Camp? That is something to think about. Of course, in comparison with prison, our camps are poisonous and harmful. Of course, they were not concerned with our souls when they pumped up the archipelago. But nonetheless, is it really hopeless to stand fast in camp? And more than that, was it really impossible for one's soul to rise in camp? Here is E.K., who was born around 1940, one of those boys who, under Khrushchev, gathered to read poems on Mayakovsky Square, but were hauled off instead in Black Mariahs. from camp, from a Potmar camp. He writes to his girl. Here, all the trivia and fuss have decreased. I have experienced a turning point. Here you hearken to that voice deep inside you, which amid the surfeit and vanity used to be stifled by the roar from outside. At the Samarka camp in 1946, a group of intellectuals had reached the very brink of death. They were worn down by hunger, cold, and work, beyond their powers. And they were even deprived of sleep. They had nowhere to lie down. Dugout barracks had not yet been built. Did they go and steal, or squeal, or whimper about their ruined lives? No. Foreseeing the approach of death in days rather than weeks, here is how they spent their last sleepless leisure, sitting up against the wall. Timofeyev Resovsky gathered them into a seminar, and they hastened to share with one another what one of them knew and the others did not. They delivered their last lectures to each other. Father Savely spoke of unshameful death, a priest academician, about patristics, one of the Uniate fathers, about something in the area of dogmatics and canonical writings, an electric engineer, on the principles of the energetics of the future, and a Leningrad economist, on how the effort to create principles of Soviet economics had failed for lack of new ideas. Timofeyev Resovsky himself talked about the principles of microphysics. From one session to the next, participants were missing. They were already in the morgue. That is the sort of person who can be interested in all this while already growing numb with approaching death. Now that is an intellectual. Pardon me, you love life? You who exclaim and sing over and over and dance it too? I love you, life. Oh, I love you, life. Do you? Well, go on, love it. Camp, life, love that too. It, too, is life. There, where there is no struggle with fate, there you will resurrect your soul. You haven't understood a thing. When you get there, you'll collapse. Along our chosen road are twists and turns and twists and turns. Uphill or up into the heavens. Let's go. Let's stumble and stagger. The day of liberation. What can it give us after so many years? We will change unrecognizably, and so will our near and dear ones, and places which once were dear to us will seem stranger than strange. And the thought of freedom after a time even becomes a forced thought, far-fetched, strange. The day of liberation, as if there were any liberty in this country, or as if it were possible to liberate anyone who has not first become liberated in his own soul. The stones roll down from under our feet, downward into the past. They are the ashes of the past. And we ascend. It is a good thing to think in prison, but it is not bad in camp either, because, and this is the main thing, there are no meetings. For 10 years you are free from all kinds of meetings. Is that not mountain air? While they openly claim your labor and your body, to the point of exhaustion and even death, the camp keepers do not encroach at all on your thoughts. They do not try to screw down your brains and to fasten them in place. Except for the unfortunate period of the White Sea-Baltic Canal and the Moscow-Volga Canal. And this results in a sensation of freedom of much greater magnitude than the freedom of one's feet to run along on the level. No one tries to persuade you to apply for party membership. No one comes around to squeeze membership dues out of you in voluntary societies. There is no trade union, the same kind of protector of your interests as an official lawyer before a tribunal. And there are no production meetings. You cannot be elected to any position. You cannot be appointed some kind of delegate. And the really important thing is that they cannot compel you to be a propagandist, nor to listen to propaganda, nor, when someone jerks the string, to shout, "We demand! We will not permit!" Nor will they ever drag you off to the electoral precinct to vote freely and secretly for a single candidate. No one requires any socialist undertakings of you, nor self-criticism of your mistakes, nor articles in the Wall newspaper, nor an interview with a provincial correspondent. A free head. Now, is that not an advantage of life in the archipelago? And there is one more freedom. No one can deprive you of your family and property. You have already been deprived of them. What does not exist, not even God can take away. And this is a basic freedom. It is good to think in imprisonment, and the most insignificant cause gives you a push in the direction of extended and important thoughts. Once in a long, long while, once in 3 years maybe, they brought a movie to camp. The film turned out to be the cheapest kind of sports comedy, The First Glove. It was a bore, but from the screen they kept drumming into the audience the moral of the film. The result is what counts, and the result is not in your favour. On the screen they kept laughing. In the hall the audience kept laughing too. But blinking as you came out into the sunlit camp yard, you kept thinking about this phrase. And during the evening you kept thinking about it on your bunk. And Monday morning out in line-up, and you could keep thinking about it as long as you wanted. And where else could you have concentrated on it like that? And slow clarity descended into your brain. This is no joke. This was an infectious thought. It has long since been inculcated in our fatherland, and they keep on inculcating it over and over. The concept that only the material result counts has become so much a part of us that when, for example, some Tukhachevsky, Yagoda, or Zinoviev was proclaimed a traitor who had sidled up to the enemy, people only exclaimed in a chorus of astonishment, "What more could he want?" Now, that is a high moral plane for you. Now, that is a real unit of measure for you. What more could he want? Since he had a belly full of chow, and 20 suits, and 2 country homes, and an automobile, and an airplane, and fame, what more could he want? Millions of our compatriots find it unthinkable to imagine that a human being, and I'm not speaking here of this particular trio, might have been motivated by something other than material gain. To such an extent has everyone been indoctrinated with and absorbed the slogan, "The result is what counts." Whence did this come to us? In the first place, from the glory of our banners and the so-called honour of our motherland. We choked, cut down, and cut up all our neighbours in our expansion, and in our fatherland it became well established that the result is what counts. And then from our Demidovs, Kabans, and Tsibukins, they clambered up without looking behind them to see whose ears they were smashing with their jackboots. And ever more firmly it became established among a once pious and open-hearted people, the result is what counts. And then, from all kinds of socialists, and most of all from the most modern, infallible, and intolerant teaching, which consists of this one thing only, the result is what counts. It is important to forge a fighting party, and to seize power, and to hold on to power, and to remove all enemies, and to conquer in pig iron and steel, and to launch rockets. And though for this industry and for these rockets it was necessary to sacrifice the way of life and the integrity of the family and the spiritual health of the people and the very soul of our fields and forests and rivers, to hell with them. The result is what counts. But that is a lie. Here we have been breaking our backs for years at all union hard labour. Here in slow annual spirals we have been climbing up to an understanding of life. And from this height it can all be seen so clearly. It is not the result that counts. It is not the result, but the spirit. Not what, but how. Not what has been attained, but at what price. And so it is with us, the prisoners. If it is the result which counts, then it is also true that one must survive at any price. And what that means is, one must become a stool pigeon, betray one's comrades, and thereby get oneself set up comfortably, and perhaps even get time off sentence. In the light of the infallible teaching, there is Evidently, nothing reprehensible in this. After all, if one does that, then the result will be in our favor, and the result is what counts. No one is going to argue. It is pleasant to win, but not at the price of losing one's human countenance. If it is the result which counts, you must strain every nerve and sinew to avoid general work. You must bend down, be servile, act meanly, yet hang on to your position as a trustee, and by this means survive. If it is the essence that counts, then the time has come to reconcile yourself to general work, to tatters, to torn skin on the hands, to a piece of bread which is smaller and worse, and perhaps to death. But while you're alive, you drag your way along proudly with an aching back. And that is when you have ceased to be afraid of threats and are not chasing after rewards, you become the most dangerous character in the owl-like view of the bosses, because what hold do they have on you? You even begin to like carrying hand barrows with rubbish, yes, but not with stone, and discussing with your workmate how the movies influence literature. You begin to like sitting down on the empty cement mixing trough and lighting up a smoke next to your bricklaying. And you are actually and simply proud if, when the foreman passes you, he squints at your courses, checks their alignment with the rest of the wall, and says, "Did you lay that? Good line." You need that wall, like you need a hole in the head, nor do you believe it is going to bring closer the happy future of the people. But, pitiful, tattered slave that you are, you smile at this creation of your own hands. The anarchist's daughter, Galia Benediktova, worked as a nurse in the medical section, but when she saw that what went on there was not healing, but only the business of getting fixed up in a good spot, out of stubbornness, she left and went off to general work, taking up a spade and a sledgehammer. And she says that this saved her spiritually. For a good person, even a crust is healthy food, and to an evil person, even meat brings no benefit. Now, that is no doubt how it really is, but what if there is not even a crust? And as soon as you have renounced that aim of surviving at any price, and gone where the calm and simple people go, then imprisonment begins to transform your former character in an astonishing way, to transform it in a direction most unexpected to you. And it would seem that in this situation, feelings of malice, the disturbance of being oppressed, aimless hate, irritability, and nervousness ought to multiply. The revolutionaries of the past left many traces of this. Serafimovich, in one of his stories, describes the society of the exiles in this way. The Bolshevik Olminsky writes, "Bitterness and spite, these feelings are so familiar to the prisoner, so close to his soul. He used to pour out his anger on those who came to visit him. He writes that he lost all taste for work, too. But then the Russian revolutionaries, in the overwhelming mass, did not get and did not serve out any real long sentences. But you yourself do not notice how, with the impalpable flow of time, slavery nurtures in you the shoots of contradictory feelings. Once upon a time, you were sharply intolerant. You were constantly in a rush, and you were constantly short of time. And now you have time, with interest. You are surfeited with it, with its months and its years behind you and ahead of you, and a beneficial calming fluid pours through your blood vessels. Patience. You are ascending. Formerly, you never forgave anyone. You judged people without mercy, and you praised people with equal lack of moderation. And now an understanding mildness has become the basis of your uncategorical judgments. You have come to realize your own weakness, and you can therefore understand the weakness of others, and be astonished at another's strength, and wish to possess it yourself. The stones rustle beneath our feet. We are ascending. With the years, armor-plated restraint covers your heart and all your skin. You do not hasten to question, and you do not hasten to answer. Your tongue has lost its flexible capacity for easy oscillation. Your eyes do not flash with gladness over good tidings, nor do they darken with grief. For you still have to verify whether that's how it is going to be, and you also have to work out what is gladness and what is grief. And now the rule of your life is this: do not rejoice when you have found, do not weep when you have lost. Your soul, which formerly was dry, now ripens from suffering, and even if you haven't come to love your neighbors in the Christian sense, you are at least learning to love those close to you. Those close to you in spirit who surround you in slavery. And how many of us come to realize it is particularly in slavery that for the first time we have learned to recognize genuine friendship. And also those close to you in blood who surrounded you in your former life, who loved you while you played the tyrant over them. Here is a rewarding and inexhaustible direction for your thoughts. Reconsider all your previous life. Remember everything you did that was bad and shameful, and take thought. Can't you possibly correct it now? Yes, you have been imprisoned for nothing. You have nothing to repent of before the state and its laws. But, before your own conscience, but, in relation to other individuals. Following an operation, I am lying in the surgical ward of a camp hospital. I cannot move. I am hot and feverish, but nonetheless my thoughts do not dissolve into delirium, and I am grateful to Dr. Boris Nikolaevich Kornfeld, who is sitting beside my cot and talking to me all evening. The light has been turned out, so it will not hurt my eyes. He and I, and there is no one else in the ward. Fervently he tells me the long story of his conversion from Judaism to Christianity. This conversion was accomplished by an educated, cultivated person, one of his cellmates, some good-natured old fellow like Platon Karatayev. I am astonished at the conviction of the new convert, at the ardor of his words. We know each other very slightly, and he was not the one responsible for my treatment, but there was simply no one here with whom he could share his feelings. He was a gentle and well-mannered person. I could see nothing bad in him, nor did I know anything bad about him. However, I was on guard, because Kornfeld had now been living for 2 months in the hospital barracks without going outside, because he had shut himself up in here at his place of work and avoided moving around camp at all. This meant he was afraid of having his throat cut. In our camp it had recently become fashionable to cut the throats of stool pigeons. This has an effect, but who could guarantee that only stoolies were getting their throats cut? One prisoner had had his throat cut in a clear case of settling a sordid grudge, and therefore the self-imprisonment of Kornfeld in the hospital did not yet prove at all that he was a stool pigeon. It is already late. All the hospital is asleep. Kornfeld is ending up his story thus: "And on the whole, do you know, I have become convinced that there is no punishment that comes to us in this life on earth which is undeserved. Superficially, it can have nothing to do with what we are guilty of in actual fact, but if you go over your life with a fine-tooth comb and ponder it deeply, you will always be able to hunt down that transgression of yours for which you have now received this blow." I cannot see his face. Through the window come only the scattered reflections of the lights of the perimeter outside, and the door from the corridor gleams in a yellow electrical glow. But there is such mystical knowledge in his voice that I shudder. These were the last words of Boris Kornfeld. Noiselessly he went out into the night-time corridor, and into one of the nearby wards, and there lay down to sleep. Everyone slept, and there was no one with whom he could speak even one word. And I went off to sleep myself. And I was wakened in the morning by running about and tramping in the corridor. The orderlies were carrying Kornfeld's body to the operating room. He had been dealt 8 blows on the skull with a plasterer's mallet while he still slept. In our camp it was the custom to kill immediately after rising time, when the barracks were all unlocked and open, and when no one yet had got up, when no one was stirring. And he died on the operating table without regaining consciousness. And so it happened that Cornfeld's prophetic words were his last words on earth, and directed to me, they lay upon me as an inheritance. You cannot brush off that kind of inheritance by shrugging your shoulders. But by that time I myself had matured to similar thoughts. I would have been inclined to endow his words with the significance of a universal law of life. However, one can get all tangled up that way. One would have to admit that on that basis those who had been punished even more cruelly than with prison, those shot, burned at the stake, were some sort of super-evildoers. And yet the innocent are those who get punished most zealously of all. And what would one then have to say about our so evident torturers? Why does not fate punish them? Why do they prosper? And the only solution to this would be that the meaning of earthly existence lies not, as we have grown used to thinking, in prospering, but in the development of the soul. From that point of view, our torturers have been punished most horribly of all. They are turning into swine. They are departing downward from humanity. From that point of view, punishment is inflicted on those whose development holds out hope. But there was something in Cornfeld's last words that touched a sensitive chord, and that I accept quite completely for myself. And many will accept the same for themselves. In the seventh year of my imprisonment, I had gone over and re-examined my life quite enough, and had come to understand why everything had happened to me, both prison and, as an additional piece of ballast, my malignant tumor. And I would not have murmured, even if all that punishment had been considered inadequate. Punishment? But whose? Well, just think about that. Whose? I lay there a long time in that recovery room from which Cornfeld had gone forth to his death, and all alone during sleepless nights I pondered with astonishment my own life and the turns it had taken. In accordance with my established camp custom, I set down my thoughts in rhymed verses, so as to remember them. And the most accurate thing is to cite them here, just as they came from the pillow of a hospital patient, when the hard labor camp was still shuddering outside the windows in the wake of a revolt. When was it that I completely scattered the good seeds, one and all? For after all, I spent my boyhood in the bright singing of thy temples. Bookish subtleties sparkled brightly, piercing my arrogant brain. The secrets of the world were in my grasp, life's destiny as pliable as wax. Blood seethed, and every swirl gleamed iridescently before me. Without a rumble, the building of my faith quietly crumbled within my heart. But passing here between being and nothingness, stumbling and clutching at the edge, I look behind me with a grateful tremor upon the life that I have lived. Not with good judgment nor with desire are its twists and turns illumined, but with the even glow of the higher meaning, which became apparent to me only later on. And now, with measuring cup returned to me, scooping up the living water, God of the universe, I believe again, though I renounced you, you were with me. Looking back, I saw that for my whole conscious life I had not understood either myself or my strivings. What had seemed for so long to be beneficial now turned out in actuality to be fatal. And I had been striving to go in the opposite direction to that which was truly necessary to me. But just as the waves of the sea knock the inexperienced swimmer off his feet and keep tossing him back onto the shore, so also was I painfully tossed back on dry land by the blows of misfortune. And it was only because of this that I was able to travel the path which I had always really wanted to travel. It was granted me to carry away from my prison years on my bent back, which nearly broke beneath its load, this essential experience, how a human being becomes evil and how good. In the intoxication of youthful successes, I had felt myself to be infallible, and I was, therefore, cruel. In the surfeit of power, I was a murderer and an oppressor. In my most evil moments, I was convinced that I was doing good, and I was well supplied with systematic arguments. And it was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart, and through all human hearts. This line shifts inside us. It oscillates with the years. And even within hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained. And even in the best of all hearts, there remains an unuprooted small corner of evil. Since then, I've come to understand the truth of all the religions of the world. They struggle with the evil inside a human being, inside every human being. It is impossible to expel evil from the world in its entirety, but it is possible to constrict it within each person. And since that time, I've come to understand the falsehood of all the revolutions in history. They destroy only those carriers of evil contemporary with them, and also fail, out of haste, to discriminate the carriers of good as well. And they then take to themselves as their heritage the actual evil itself, magnified still more. The Nuremberg trials have to be regarded as one of the special achievements of the 20th century. They killed the very idea of evil, though they killed very few of the people who had been infected with it. Of course, Stalin deserves no credit here. He would have preferred to explain less and shoot more. And if by the 21st century humanity has not yet blown itself up and has not suffocated itself, perhaps it is this direction that will triumph. Yes, and if it does not triumph, then all humanity's history will have turned out to be an empty exercise in marking time, without the tiniest mite of meaning. Whither and to what end will we otherwise be moving? To beat the enemy over the head with a club? Even cavemen knew that. Know thyself. There is nothing that so aids and assists the awakening of omniscience within us as insistent thoughts about one's own transgressions, errors, mistakes. After the difficult cycles of such ponderings over many years, whenever I mention the heartlessness of our highest-ranking bureaucrats, the cruelty of our executioners, I remember myself in my captain's shoulder boards and the forward march of my battery through East Prussia, enshrouded in fire, and I say, so were we any better? When people express vexation in my presence over the West's tendency to crumble, its political short-sightedness, its divisiveness, its confusion, I recall, too. Were we, before passing through the archipelago, more steadfast, firmer in our thoughts? And that is why I turn back to the years of my imprisonment and say, sometimes to the astonishment of those about me, bless you, prison. Lev Tolstoy was right when he dreamed of being put in prison. At a certain moment, that giant began to dry up. He actually needed prison, as a drought needs a shower of rain. All the writers who wrote about prison, but who did not themselves serve time there, considered it their duty to express sympathy for prisoners and to curse prison. I have served enough time there. I nourished my soul there. And I say without hesitation, bless you, prison, for having been in my life. And from beyond the grave come replies. It is very well for you to say that, when you came out of it alive. Chapter 2. Or Corruption. But I have been brought up short. You are not talking about the subject at all. You've got off the track again, onto prison. And what you are supposed to be talking about is camp. But I was also, I thought, talking about camp. Well, all right, I'll shut up. I shall give some space to contrary opinions. Many camp inmates will object to what I have said and will say that they did not observe any ascent of the soul, that this is nonsense, and that corruption took place at every step. More insistent and more significant than others, because he had already written about all this, was Sharamov's objection. In the camp situation, human beings never remain human beings. The camps were created to this end. All human emotions, love, friendship, envy, love of one's fellows, mercy, thirst for fame, honesty, fell away from us along with the meat of our muscles. We had no pride, no vanity, and even jealousy and passion seemed to be Martian concepts. The only thing left was anger, the most enduring of human emotions. We came to understand that truth and falsehood were kin sisters. Friendship is born neither of need nor of misfortune. If friendship does arise between human beings, it means that conditions are not that difficult. If misfortune and need have joined hands, it means they were not in extremis. Grief is insufficiently sharp and deep if it can be shared with friends. There is only one distinction here to which Shalimov agrees. Ascent, growth in profundity, the development of human beings is possible in prison, but camp is wholly and consistently a negative school of life. There is nothing either necessary or useful that anyone derived from it. The prisoner learns flattery, falsehood, and petty and large-scale meanness. When he returns home, he sees not only that he has not grown during his time in camp, but that his interests have become meager and crude. Shalimov also considers it an indication of the human being's oppression and corruption in camp that he lives there for long years, subject to someone else's will, to someone else's mind. But this is something I have chosen to set aside in a footnote, because in the first place one can say just the same thing about many free people, not counting the scope for activity and minor details which prisoners have as well, and because, in the second place, the fatalistic character, obligatorily instilled into the native of the archipelago by his ignorance of his fate and his inability to influence it, tends rather to ennoble him, to free him from fruitless bustle. Why, Ginsberg also agrees with this distinction, prison ennobled people while camp corrupted them. And how can one object to that? In prison, both in solitary confinement and outside solitary too, a human being confronts his grief face to face. This grief is a mountain, but he has to find space inside himself for it, to familiarize himself with it, to digest it, and it him. This is the highest form of moral effort, which has always ennobled every human being. How interesting people become in prison. I have known people who became tiresome bores after their release, yet in prison you simply couldn't tear yourself away from conversations with them. A duel with years and with walls constitutes moral work and a path upward, if you can climb it. If you share those years with a comrade, it is never in a situation in which you are called on to die in order to save his life, nor is it necessary for him to die in order for you to survive. You have the possibility of entering not into conflict, but into mutual support and enrichment. But in camp, it would appear, you do not have that path. Bread is not issued in equal pieces, but thrown onto a pile. Go grab. Knock down your neighbors and tear it out of their hands. The quantity of bread issued is such that one or two people have to die for each who survives. The bread is hung high up on a pine tree. Go fell it. The bread is deposited in a coal mine. Go down and mine it. Can you think about your own grief, about the past and the future, about humanity and God? Your mind is absorbed in vain calculations which for the present moment cut you off from the heavens, and tomorrow are worth nothing. You hate labor. It is your principal enemy. You hate your companions, rivals in life and death. P. Yakubovich declared, "Nearly every hard labor convict dislikes every other one." Yet where he was, there was no competition for survival. You are reduced to a frazzle by intense envy and alarm lest somewhere behind your back others are right now dividing up that bread which could be yours, that somewhere on the other side of the wall a tiny potato is being ladled out of the pot which could have ended up in your own bowl. Camp life was organized in such a way that envy pecked at your soul from all sides, even the best defended soul. Envy also extended to terms and to release itself. In 1945, we, the 58s, had to see the non-political offenders off at the gates as a result of Stalin's amnesty. What were our feelings toward them? Gladness for them because they were going home? No, it was envy because it was unjust to free them and to hold us. And V. Vlasov, who got a 20-year term, served out his first 10 years calmly, for who was not serving out 10 years? But in 1947 to 1948 they began to release many others, and he envied them, got nervous, and was eating his heart out. How was it that he had received a sentence of 20? How galling it was to have to serve that second tenor. And I did not ask him, but I suppose that when those others began to return to camp as repeaters, he then must have calmed down. And in 1955 to 1956, the 58s were being released on a mass scale, and the non-political offenders were left in the camps. What did they feel at that point? A sense of justice because the long-suffering article, after 40 years of incessant persecutions, had at long last been pardoned? No. In fact, it was universal envy. I received many letters of this sort in 1963. They had freed the enemies who were far worse than us habitual criminals. And why, then, are we still here? For what? And in addition, you are constantly gripped by fear of slipping off even that pitifully low level to which you are clinging, of losing your work, which is still not the hardest, of coming a cropper on a prison transport, of ending up in a strict regimen camp. And on top of that, you got beaten if you were weaker than all the rest, or else you yourself beat up those weaker than you. And wasn't this corruption? Soul mange is what A. Rubailo, an old camp veteran, called this swift decay under external pressure. Amid these vicious feelings and tense, petty calculations, when and on what foundation could you ascend? Chekhov, even before our corrective labor camps, observed and identified this soul corruption on Sakhalin. He wrote correctly that the vices of prisoners arose from their lack of freedom, enslavement, terror, and constant hunger. And their vices were dishonesty, slyness, cowardice, faint-heartedness, stool-pigeoning, thievery. Experience had demonstrated to the hard labor convict that in the struggle for existence, deceit was the most reliable means. And wasn't all this multiplied tenfold among us? So isn't it the right time not to object, and not to rise to the fence of some sort of alleged camp ascent, but to describe hundreds, thousands of cases of genuine soul corruption? To cite examples of how no one could resist the camp philosophy of Yashka, the Jezkazgan worker signer. The more you spit on people, the more they'll esteem you. To tell how newly arrived frontline soldiers in Krasnoyarsk in 1942, had no sooner scented the thieves' atmosphere than they themselves undertook to play the thief, to plunder the Lithuanians and to fatten up off their foodstuffs and possessions. You greenhorns can go die. Or how certain Vlasov men began to pass for thieves out of the conviction that that was the only way to survive in camp. Or about that assistant professor of literature who became a thief ringleader. Or to be astounded via the example of Chulpenyov at how infectious that camp ideology was. Chulpenyov stood it for 7 years on general work at timbering and became a famous lumberjack, but landed in a hospital with a broken leg and was subsequently offered a position as a worker's signer. He had no need for this job. He could certainly have dragged out as a lumberjack the 2.5 years he had still to serve, since the management made a great fuss over him. But how could he turn down the temptation? After all, it is a rule of camp philosophy. If they give, take it. And Chulpenyov became a worker signer for just 6 months, which were the most restless, troubled, and dismal of his whole term. And it is now a long time since his term was served out, and he will tell you with an open-hearted smile about the tall pines. But there is a stone on his heart because of those who died as a result of his slave driving, a Latvian 6.5 feet tall, a captain who had sailed the seven seas. Yes, and was he the only one? Conscious instigation of one prisoner against another can lead to just such awful soul mange. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.